You're listening to the LA Rams Reports Flipping the Tables podcast.
First and 10 from the 27. Warner back to throw. Rainbow's the far sideline, and it is caught by Isaac Bruce. Makes a move to the 30, 25, 20, and they won't catch him today.
Yes.
Touchdown Rams!
73 yards for the Reverend Ike.
And now, here's your hosts, Josh Webb and Cameron Worrell.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to an all-new Flipping the Tables podcast. Man, it seems like the week, the day, the hour, or whatever it is that we were waiting for has been taking forever and ever and ever. But it is finally passed, and now I am here with Cam Worrell, fresh off our trip. Not only down to a passing down, but his actually a wedding for him as well, to discuss the draft. What a crazy week it's been, Cam. How you doing, man? First of all, congratulations on the nuptials of your sister.
Yeah, doing great. Coming off a passing down, jumping right into a wedding weekend over on the coast. Stressful time leading up to it, but, you know, everything went off without a hitch. It was a great night, and you know, it was a nice cap to the end of the spring. Like, for me, it's been a little bit crazy. So it'll be nice to kind of chill in May and kind of have some weekends off to hang out around the house, because it's been pretty crazy. But it was an awesome weekend.
And, you know, it was an awesome week for the Rams as well, who, as everybody and their mother expected, drafted Jared Goff. There really never was a debate. NFL insiders had been telling you it was going to be Goff. The Rams had been doing their part to maybe make you believe that it could be Wentz. Jeff Fisher with his, oh, he's going to win a Super Bowl comments. Rather specific comments about Carson Wentz that make you think, maybe it's him. No, it wasn't him. And certainly was not that lone comment that Jeff Fisher said on the NFL Network when they had just made the trade. He's like, you know, I'm a defensive guy. No, you're not. It was Jared Goff. So let's start there, man, because I have been Team Wentz. You have been Team Goff. All that matters is what Kroenke, Snead, and Fisher were. That was Team Goff. Why do you think eventually at the end of the day it came down to Goff? What do you think won them over?
I think, and I've heard this story a couple of times. I'm sure people are familiar with the story of Jeff Fisher and Les Snead going out to North Dakota to work out Carson Wentz, then coming to Berkeley to work out Jared Goff. And, there were some question marks around Jared Goff as far as, you know, he's a California kid. He's played in the Pac-12. He went to, you know, California. So you don't really have to play in the elements and, you know, by whatever chance. It was pouring down rain the second half of his workout, and he kind of thrived in that setting. And I think, you know, there are some absurd kind of question marks around prospects. You know, Jared Goff has small hands, and is that going to affect him throwing a wet football? But, I mean, from the outside looking in, it sounds ridiculous. But when you're investing as much as the Rams have invested in that number one pick, moving up, you know, giving away so many assets, they have to hit a home run with this pick. And I think it came down to them seeing Jared Goff perform in person. His pace, you know, gives you a ton of information. You see him throw at the combine, but, you know, I really think that was how Jared Goff was able to close the deal and become the number one pick of the draft. He impressed during that workout. He kind of squashed any concerns about, you know, whether his hand size would affect him throwing a football in the elements. And they came away so impressed with him that he became the number one guy. I know we went back and forth a lot about, you know, Carson Wentz getting dinged for, you know, playing at North Dakota State and playing the level of competition he played. But I really do think with the amount of information teams had on Jared Goff in comparison to Carson Wentz, that in the end, if you put these two guys, you know, on a level playing field as far as your evaluation of them, because you have more information on Jared Goff, that's the easier pick to make. And neither of them are easier, but because you have so much information, because you have such a track record. You have so many throws to break down. I think they were just much more comfortable making that decision and moving forward with Jared Goff at the number one spot as opposed to Carson Wentz.
Yeah, and you know, Goff's confidence was definitely there because I think, you know, alluding to that story you had mentioned, like I think when they called him up and let him know that they were coming in, he said, I believe it was, "I hope it rains tomorrow." Because he wanted the inclement weather. He wanted to be able to show, I hate this phrase because I have no idea what it means, but he wanted to show them that he could do it in NFL weather. And, it you know, I can understand why if you're on the fence about both guys and you go and visit one guy and it, all of a sudden the conditions just turn absolutely crappy and the guy is still nailing every single throw, I can see why as decision makers you would feel more comfortable with that pick. I could see how that type of environment could make you feel more locked into what you were picking. And it sort of seems like a nuanced thing, does it? Like, that situation could have just as easily happened to Carson Wentz, right? Like, for you know, the gods could have made it sunny in Northern California that day and absolute ass out in Fargo, North Dakota, and Carson Wentz could have been slinging it all over the place, and that may have been what did it in for him. So I do think that there's a bit of luck that does go into the situation, just sort of luck of how the situation plays out, you know? For a lot of these guys, when you step into interviews, you're, and I mean, maybe you can relay to your own experience what it was like, but I know I was talking to Buffalo Bills cornerback now, Kevon Seymour, and he was telling me when he was going through his draft process, you know, the cornerback at USC going through the draft process, and it was just flight after flight after flight after flight, meeting with teams, getting on one plane, getting on another, and there's no real downtime. And if you came from, say, I'm not going to say a bad interview, but maybe an interview that you don't feel went well or an interview that shook you up, maybe the particular GM at that table was asking some seriously inappropriate questions, and it just left you shaken and rattled, and then you go into an interview that you really want, you might not perform as well. That's why I say there's a bit of luck with it. But I think that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was just seeing Goff in those inclement conditions and saying, okay, this guy can do it in NFL weather. He's also got the higher volume of throws that we've seen. We love both of these guys. We just, our gut says go with Goff. Like, that's just the way we're leaning. Do you believe, I guess the question here is this. First part, you know, what was your experience like when you went through the interview process of you know, either being drafted or not being drafted? But the second thing is that I want to ask you is, do you feel like this could have easily happened to Wentz, or was there a little bit more to it?
Yeah, I think the way this happened to Jared Goff was kind of perfect. And had this happened to Carson Wentz, I don't think it would have been as big of a deal or would have been as impressive as it was for Jared Goff, because Carson Wentz grew up in North Dakota, played at North Dakota State. I know they play in a dome, but you have to play games in some pretty bad weather up in that conference. So, yeah, you know, I think those question marks surrounding Carson Wentz and playing in weather and things like that didn't really exist. Those were, I mean, really some of the bigger concerns about Jared Goff as far as his transition to the NFL was, can he handle those types of games that you're going to have to handle in the NFL. And I think it was just literally and figuratively a perfect storm that day that, you know, allowed the Rams to see him perform in that type of weather. So it just kind of happened that way. And I think it was, you know, fortuitous for Jared Goff to be able to kind of squash the concerns that coaching staff had in regards to him and performing in those types of situations. For me, like, I was you know, most of my interviews were done at Fresno State. You know, most of them were done. We had a couple of pro days, and most of my interviews were done at those pro days. I wasn't a prospect. I talked on the phone to a lot of teams, but I wasn't a prospect that was flown. I actually had no visits. I didn't fly anywhere. I had a couple workouts on campus at Fresno State. But for me, it was more nerve-wracking because, you know, I had great tape as a senior. I had a, you know, decent tape as a junior, very productive as a senior. My numbers matched up with a lot of safety prospects out there coming out in the draft. And, you know, most of the teams that I talked to, you know, the Dolphins, the Bengals, the 49ers, the Bears, like leading up to the draft, was all positive conversation. And I even spoke to, you know, back in 2003, there was only 2 days of the draft. So I think rounds 1 through 3 were on Saturday. 4 through 7 were on Sunday. And I knew I wasn't going Saturday. I knew that for sure. But Sunday morning, I talked to the Dolphins, I talked to the Bengals, I talked to the Bears, and all of them, all three teams said, we have you on our board. We have some picks in the 6th. We have some picks in the 7th. If you're not one of those picks, we'll call you towards the end of the draft, and we want to bring you in as a free agent. So I was, you know, anticipating hearing my name called, getting a phone call, and if not, you know, definitely hearing from teams towards the end of the draft, and the draft is moving on. We're getting late in the 7th round. The Dolphins had a couple picks. They pick another safety out of South Carolina. The Bears ended up drafting the guy in the 4th round, Todd Johnson, who's one of my best friends now. So I'm sitting there waiting all day long, and no calls towards the end of the draft, no calls after the draft. I didn't hear from any team until the next day. So I went to sleep like, man, my football career is over. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I get a call Monday, and the Bears offer me a mini camp tryout. So they'll find me out, you know, if I were to tear my ACL or do anything. No injury coverage, no injury protection. That's just all on me. And, you know, go out there, impress, and get a basically, you know, an invite to training camp, sign a 3-year deal, which means nothing, no guaranteed money. Went to training camp, and kind of the rest is history. But it was a different type of nerve-wracking for me leading up to the draft. It was just some things I thought were going to happen didn't, and you know, everything kind of worked out in the end. But it was a crazy time, and I had Sam Williams, who played for the Raiders for 8 years, a real good friend of mine, worked teammate at Fresno State. You know, he was flying out, he was meeting with teams. And, you know, I thought, man, what's going on? I'm not getting any calls. I'm not getting any love. I'm not flying anywhere. And, you know, it kind of worked out the way that it did for the better. You know, I went to Chicago. I played there for 4 years and had my options to leave as a free agent. Ended up coming back the next year and playing and finishing my career. But, yeah, it was a crazy time leading up to the draft.
And I would venture to guess that your story, I just want to spend a moment talking about this because it's in no way, shape, or form Rams related, but it's easily the story of the draft. How much does someone have to hate you? How much does someone have to despise your entire being to send out a video like, I'm not going to say like the one Laramie sent out, because I truly, in my heart of hearts, I do not believe Tunsil sent that video. There are a lot of times when I see a player say, I got hacked, and I'm like, no, you didn't.
Right.
Like, there are a billion times, and I just roll my eyes. This is the one time where I can unequivocally state, I absolutely do. Tunsil did not send that video, or he is the dumbest human being on the planet. If Laramie sat there and said send on that video, then I'll eat a bowl of dog crap. God, please don't have sent that video, Laramie. Please don't have sent that video. But how much does either, because there were some rumors that it was the stepdad, but then I also saw later on, maybe, you know, a couple picks later, after the whole thing had come out, that people were saying it could have been a burned financial advisor, which I don't know if I buy that one as much, because then the Instagram tweets came out, and I can't see any reason why a financial advisor would create that. Like, that just, That guy is not going to have a career if that were the case. This thing reeks of his stepdad to me. First and foremost, how much of a steal did the Dolphins get with this kid? And how much of an asshole was his stepdad?
I mean, I can't imagine somebody... Yeah, and I'm with you. There's no way Laramie Tunsil fit this himself. Just no way. No one's going to sabotage their own NFL career to do...
Not that much money. Not that much money.
And for his stepdad, who, you know, looks like sent these things out, I can't imagine feeling that negatively towards somebody to do something like that, to sabotage somebody's career. It's so hateful and spiteful. And yeah, Laramie Tunsil took the video. Yeah, that was him, you know, smoking weed on camera. Yeah, that was stupid in its own right. But, you know, things that you do as a younger individual, you know, are stupid. A lot of the things you do are stupid. I did a lot of stupid things as well that if they were on camera and, you know, I was a draft prospect, it would have been on TV and people would have said, this guy's the stupidest human being on planet Earth. So, yeah, he did something stupid, but to have it come out like that, and not just come out, but, you know, I had to come out a couple of days before. Like, it wouldn't have been as bad. He wouldn't have fallen as far. But because teams could not do, you know, any research or get any information about the video, people just passed him up, took him off the draft board. And the Dolphins ended up with, I mean, this could go down. And there are, you know, Laramie Tunsil has to perform. He has to stay disciplined in the NFL. Like, there's no question he has things he has to do. But this could go down as one of the all-time greatest steals in draft history. I mean, the unquestioned top prospect in the draft, regardless of position, falls to the 13th pick in the draft. And, I mean, I've seen people compare Laramie Tunsil to Tyron Smith, the Pro Bowl left tackle for the Dallas Cowboys.
I've heard Orlando Pace, too. I really have.
Right, right. And not Tyron Smith coming out of USC. Tyron Smith right now, Pro Bowler in the NFL. They see the same characteristics as him. This guy's a franchise left tackle. He is just an anchor.
He is the guy that is eventually going to put Tannehill out of his job, in my opinion, because he's the guy that's going to prove it ain't the protection that's the problem with Miami.
Right, yeah. Now it's up to Ryan Tannehill. Like, the offensive line has been an excuse. Now it's up to him to perform. But, I mean, this guy, like, literally could save a whole bunch of jobs in Miami because he is a franchise left tackle. He will anchor that offensive line for the next 12 years if he stays healthy and all that kind of stuff. But this was, I mean, this might go down as the greatest, you know, steal of any draft we've ever seen. A franchise left tackle, perennial Pro Bowl type guy at the 13th pick in the first round. It was amazing. And, you know, Miami pulled the trigger. I think Mike Tannenbaum down in Miami is probably the worst personnel person in the league that still has a job, but he got Laramie Tunsil at 13 and pulled the trigger. And, you know, I think that franchise is going to greatly benefit from bringing in a guy like that.
And you know what's funny to me is you mentioned Mike Tannenbaum, and I looked at maybe where the San Francisco 49ers picked, and Laramie Tunsil falls to them. And I'm thinking, okay, Chip Kelly, you played with Cliff Harris. You recruited Jeremiah Masoli. Who gives a crap that this guy's smoking a gas mask bong in a vine? Like, really, honestly, who cares? I've hit a gas mask bong. Ooh, let's stop the planets, you know? I saw a tweet that was going around me, and I'll circle back to Chip Kelly here, that I thought really put things in perspective. And it was somebody who says, we're holding a guy who plays left tackle in a sport more accountable for tweets than our presidential candidates. And I thought, A, that is the most pointed tweet I've seen all day. It is ridiculous that we are ripping this guy apart for what amounts to him smoking pot on camera. Like, half of America has probably been filmed in some fashion smoking weed. And if they haven't been filmed smoking weed, they've recorded themselves having stupid conversations after. I want to be as matter-of-fact about this situation as I possibly can. because I think it's ridiculous that medical marijuana or weed in general is criminalized like it is in the NFL. It's one of the stupidest things that I've seen. But this guy smokes out of a gas mask bong, and Chip Kelly, who needs help along every single position of that offensive line, says, screw it. I am not going to take the stoner, even though I recruited like 50 million of them up in Oregon. I'm going to go ahead and take a position that is not in any way, shape, or form a position of need for the Niners. And it's happened, also happens to be a guy from the college that I love, Oregon. He takes DeForest Buckner over Laremy Tunsil, and I'm sitting there going, yep, Chip Kelly is not an NFL coach. I've made up my mind right then, honestly. There wasn't one expert that I had seen on any of the draft boards projecting that the Niners really needed, actually, I take it back, there was one expert when they did the positions of need. And he listed defensive line at the very, very end of things, and he passes on this guy. Why the hell, if you are an offensive line starved organization like the Niners, who has a coach that has coached these types of players before, why do you pass on that for the best player available? Because he wasn't either in that case. DeForest Buckner was neither the best player available nor a position of need. Laremy Tunsil is always going to be the BPA in this argument. It's just whether or not you care enough about a bong hit to draft it. But he's still higher on the board than Buckner. Why would the Niners do that?
That I don't know. That's a good question. There are a lot of, you know, teams up there that you could ask that question about.
But none of them needed much help like the Niners did. They literally help across offensive tackle, guard, and center. They literally need them all, and they passed on, like you said, the number one consensus overall pick. And this is with a coach who's admittedly worked with stoner after stoner after stoner after stoner up at Oregon. Why, if you're the 49ers, do you do something as stupid as pass on Laremy Tunsil for a defensive end that you don't need? Unless you're going to convert him to an offensive lineman.
I doubt that's going to happen, and I don't know. You know, I don't know what those discussions were in that draft room with the 49ers. I know that Trent Baalke has what he considers a plan and how he likes to operate. And I don't know how much influence Chip Kelly has right now in San Francisco. I'm sure he has some, and they want to find players that fit the system. DeForest Buckner is an Oregon guy. Chip Kelly recruited him to Oregon. So I'm sure that played into it, at least in the evaluation process. But when you draft guys, look, DeForest Buckner could end up being, you know, a great defensive lineman and, could be a Pro Bowler. But how much of an impact is he going to make on that team trying to get wins? And I think when you look at he versus Laremy Tunsil in that specific, you know, situation or question, like, it's pretty evident that, you know, Laremy Tunsil as a franchise left tackle is somebody that will help your team win games for the rest of his career. And DeForest Buckner, unless he turns into J.J. Watt, he can't have the same impact as a franchise left tackle can have on that 49ers team. I don't know. You know, like I said, that video was tweeted out so close to the draft that teams couldn't do the homework they wanted to do to kind of get to the bottom of that.
But what's the diligence there? But I want to ask it in all seriousness. What due diligence do you need to do there? He smoked. The most offensive thing in that video, honestly, to me, is the Confederate flag. I'm trying to figure out why Laremy Tunsil's taking bong rips underneath the Confederate flag. I am more curious about that than anything else in this video. Like, whose house were you at when this went down? I mean, what? that That's my honest question, is why does it even matter that this guy was smoking weed when we know that the league, like, wasn't there a study going around a while ago that, like, a great chunk of the players in the league smoked? Like, they're even pushing for this to be decriminalized in the NFL. Why? I could understand if there was a video going around of, like, a bar altercation where it looked like maybe he assaulted somebody, or if there were domestic violence allegations that had surfaced. But this is weed. This is weed. You didn't take a potential all-world protector because of weed? Even the, look, man, how many NFL players, Cam, have we tweeted saying, if you don't know how to get around the NFL drug test, you're an idiot. They tell us. Like, how many NFL players have we seen tweet that? So we know that there are guys in there that can help. Let's just say Temple's still a smoker. We know that there are guys in the league who can help him skirt the issue. There's got to be GMs who can help him skirt the issue if they really wanted to invest themselves. But we knew that this guy was the consensus overall best player in the draft until it became apparent that quarterbacks were going to go 1-2. I mean, there were no questions about this. And teams were scared off by Reed.
But I don't think it, I'm sure some people were like, you know, we don't know when this video is, we don't know, you know, what
truthfully,
the...
Truthfully, does it matter?
No, it does, but here's why. I don't think the weed part of it was the biggest deal of it. Like you said, players in the NFL, you know when the drug tests come, you know when you get tested for weed, and if you pass like 2 a year, you don't have to take another one until the following, you know, the following league year. But here's why teams, without having time to understand when that video was, you know, when it occurred, where it was, it's because of this. You know, like, if you go to the combine and you fail a drug test like Randy Gregory did last year, you're an idiot. And teams look at that and say, okay, this guy had the biggest interview in his entire life. He isn't disciplined enough, intelligent enough, whatever it is, to understand I'm going to be drug tested. All I have to do is stop smoking weed, pass that drug test, then I can smoke weed again. With the Laramie Tunsil video, I don't know if it's so much about the fact that he's smoking a bong on camera, smoking weed at all. It's the fact that if this happened like a week ago with Laramie Tunsil possibly being, you know, a top 5 NFL draft pick, if he's stupid enough to allow himself to be videoed on camera smoking weed, whether we care about the weed or not, it's still illegal to do. It's against, you know, the NFL rules. Why would we draft a guy that doesn't value doing the right things enough to...
Jog my memory real quick, because I legitimately don't, I can't remember who it was. Who was it that, I remember it was like some odd years ago, that they were coming out of college with a knock against them. And I remember the knock was so severe that Goodell said he would impose a 4-game penalty. The guy wasn't going to be able to avoid it by coming to the league. And he was drafted, but he did have to serve that, I think it was a 4-game suspension. Who was that? Do you remember? You know,
I think it was Terrell Pryor.
Okay, all right. That makes sense. So, that is it. All right. So, I mean, now... Terrell Pryor is probably not the best example because he ended up going in a supplemental draft rather than the first round. But I don't think anybody had Terrell Pryor as a first-round talent. Like, I guess you have a fair point. I get the whole concept of saying this guy's an idiot, this is why we want to avoid that. It just seems really odd to me that teams, even if it was a week ago, like, it just doesn't matter. Like, to me, I'm looking at this thing going, okay, you know, if I'm going to take a chance on a guy like Robert Khandiche, who went in the first round, now I thought that was another great steal. I thought Khandiche going to the Arizona Cardinals, wait, isn't it funny that every player we're talking about with problems has come from Ole Miss? Oh, right. Fancy that. Look, they're under investigation. What do you know?
Yeah.
But you look at where Robert Khandiche landed in the division with the Arizona Cardinals, and I thought that was another outstanding fit, given what they did with a similar SEC problem child in Tyrann Mathieu. Patrick Peterson stepped right up, brought that young buck, said, you're coming in, you're moving with me, you're dumping the weed, you're dumping everything, we're going to get your head straight, and we're going to turn you into the player that we know you can be, and you're going to get more high off of that than anything else that you do. And the Arizona Cardinals have a situation set up to do the exact same thing with Robert Kim DJ. Now, why couldn't the Niners have, well, all right, I guess your point is made. The Niners don't have anybody along the offensive line to do that. You know, I guess that maybe that's what it comes to. It just seems weird to me that teams would look at this and be scared off by weed. If the guy were injecting heroin, I get it. But weed is now legal in I don't know how many different states. So it just, like, it, the criminal appeal of it to me is nil and not. Like, if Laramie Tunsil's a stoner and is that good at what he does, that's even more impressive. Like, that's my thought about it. Like, you know, and who was it that, like, pitched a World Series, or pitched a no-hitter on acid? Like, was it a Doc something for the Pittsburgh Pirates? Like, pitched a no-hitter on LSD? Like, I mean, this kind of crap happens in sports all the time. Didn't Michael Irvin used to go play high as hell on coke? I mean, he's one of the greatest receivers, and I'm not advocating drug use here, but being scared off by something as low-level on the scale of the drug continuum as weed for a player of what Laramie Tunsil's caliber could be seems kind of shocking to me. But we can put a pin in that conversation because it has little to do with the Rams. What I do want to talk about is the fact that you were right, Pam. Were you at all pleased when you looked down in the fourth round and you saw the Rams draft exactly the same player you had suggested they take in that spot?
Yeah, I was. Because I think it's a great pick for them, and we talked a lot about needing to find a tight end that has the skill set that Tyler Higbee has, and you know, luckily for them, you know, there's some concerns around Tyler Higbee and off the field, and he's looking at some issues in that regard. But yeah, it was, you know, I kind of pegged this guy. I loved watching him. You know, he has the size-speed combination that can fit into the NFL, it can fit into, you know, Jeff Fisher style of offense. So, yeah, I was extremely happy. He's going to have to, you know, get a little bit more physical at the point of attack, but he's a guy who can step on the field right now and can be a threat down the middle of the field. A guy that can run, you know, 6'5" guy that can go up and get the ball. So, yeah, I was pleased that they picked him. You know, guy who I you know, like I said, I kind of pegged who I thought a tight end that would be available that would fit kind of what they were looking for, and they ended up finding him in the fourth round, and I think it was a tremendous pick for the Rams. This is a guy who's going to – he's going to come in, and he's going to get snaps right away.
I know where I'm going to skip. Oh, we're going to come back to some of the earlier rounds, or I guess for the Rams, all later rounds. But I want to stay at that tight end position because the Rams actually took two in this draft. The second one they took was Tamarik Henningway, I believe, out of North Carolina State. And where do you come down on him? I mean, what's your opinion of him? Do you think he's a guy that's being brought in for maybe just pure blocking tight end? Because I looked over his stats at NC State. South Carolina State. I misspoke. South Carolina State. I look over his stats there, and they're modest receiving numbers. Like, you can clearly tell that this guy is more of an end in the tight end than the tight package. He's a guy that seems to play more along the offensive line and maybe used to bolster some of those protection schemes for Goff, maybe, you know, as they introduce him to an NFL playbook. Do you like the pick? Do you think they could have used that elsewhere? Because we know they had positions in need, and to be quite honest, they kind of addressed most of them with the exception of cornerback.
Yeah, I think Tamarik Henningway is the key. He's a really good athlete as well, you know, similarly built as Higbee. But I think Henningway is going to be more of that move tight end guy. I think they're going to move him around a lot. He's going to be in the backfield. You know, he's going to be that kind of H-back that plays on the line of scrimmage or, you know, gets in the backfield. They can, you know, use some two tight end sets because you do have Todd Gurley and you want to get some bigger guys on the field. And, you know, Hemingway can be that move guy. That's where I see him fitting in this Rams offense. You know, he'll be more of that guy. You can see Higbee being that stretch guy, being that, you know, kind of like Cook was, you know, widen him out, put him in, you know, space and allow him to work. And Hemingway is more of that inline guy who can be a blocker. He can run, too. You know, he can run routes. He has good ball skills. He's a guy who, you know, played at a lower level, so it's going to take some time to develop, but he's a raw athlete. And when you can add those types of guys to a position of need, I think you go after it. You know, I think he has a really high upside, as Higbee does, but you get Hemingway in the sixth round, I think you can use him right away in that H-back kind of a role. You can move him around a little bit. You know, I think it makes the Rams offensive, you know, makes them more physical than they were before the draft. Getting both of these guys, you add kind of that vertical presence down the hash, and you add Hemingway, who can be, you know, more of a move inline blocker at the point of attack. And I think you've really bolstered the physicality of your offense. And that's why I think you saw that pick with Hemingway, a guy who has really, really good athleticism and can make an impact right away. I think that's why you saw him double up on the tight end spot. Two different guys, you know, Hemingway is going to be the grinder. Higbee is going to be that vertical guy. But I think they got really two really solid players that can come in and help this offense right away.
And another position that they drafted two up were two wide receivers. Now I want to talk about Pharaoh Cooper first, because I don't know why they drafted the slot guy earlier and then drafted maybe the outside target a little bit later. I don't like the Pharaoh Cooper pick, but I understand why they made it. Where do you come down on it?
Yeah, I mean, you look at Pharaoh Cooper, and who's the first guy that comes to mind when you watch him play? Tavon Austin, right? I mean, he looks very similar to Tavon Austin. I think he has a very similar skill set to Tavon Austin. He's a return guy. He's super quick in space. He doesn't have the long speed that Tavon Austin has. You know, Pharaoh Cooper is more of a quick receiver as opposed to, you know, a straight line speed guy. But look, we talked a lot about Braxton Miller leading up to the draft and how he would fit with the Rams, how they would be able to develop him, how he would immediately be, you know, a threat in the slot, in the return game, and that's what Pharaoh Cooper is. You know, 5'11", 200 pounds, he's not tiny. You know, I think he is a guy that can not just work the slot, but can develop into a guy that can play on the outside a little bit. Look, you draft Jared Goff number one, you know you have to upgrade the weapons around him. That's been one of our, you know, key points in every podcast that we've talked about. You have to upgrade the weapons on this offense. And Pharaoh Cooper is a guy who was available in the fourth round. And, you know, I think he's a guy who played a lot at South Carolina, played a lot in the SEC. I think he's a guy who can step on the field right away and make an impact. And I think you saw a lot of guys, even though they may have to develop, you saw the Rams picking up prospects that can help and will grow with Jared Goff. This draft was all about Jared Goff, and it was all about getting weapons to help Jared Goff, because as Jared Goff goes, this Rams franchise now goes, so you need to give him as many weapons and supplement that offense with as many guys that can make impact on the field as possible, and Pharaoh Cooper is one of those guys.
And I get that. I should state for the record that the reason I don't like it is because I feel like they need that explosive primary target. And I don't know that there were a ton of those available in the fourth round or the fifth round or even the sixth round. But I just don't know that they – here's my ultimate question. If Stedman Bailey comes back and he's working his ass off too, and I'm just going to be honest right now, I've got no reason to believe that Stedman Bailey can't make a return. Look, I've seen guys, if you make it to the NFL, your body is a machine. Like, it is working at optimal speeds and operating at ultimate efficiency at all times. Like, it has to be able to withstand what you're going to go through on a weekly basis. And I know he was shot in the head, but if there's a guy out there that's going to do it, it's going to be a football player. They're going to make, and on top of that, I remember there was a local MMA prospect that got shot twice on 4th of July. Lavelle, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, Lavelle Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. It was like a couple 4th of Julys ago. He got shot down here in Bakersfield a couple of times, and he was back in the cage fighting. It took him a while to recover, which Stedman Bailey's been out. But look, man, if he can step back into the octagon, I've got no reason to doubt that Stedman Bailey can't make it back onto a football field. So at that point, if you're the Rams, what do you do? Because now all of a sudden you've got three of the exact same player.
Yeah, but you also have talent and competition at a position that you didn't have it before. And I think, when we talked about this a lot, we talked about you have to add some pieces. You have to bring some guys in that can not just compete, but can make an impact, that can upgrade the talent you have on your roster. And hopefully Stedman Bailey comes back. There's really no guarantee that he will be back, especially in 2016. But if you have a problem of too many good receivers, I think that's a good problem to have in LA, because you have not had that, for a long time. You haven't. And anytime you can upgrade, Farrell Cooper could have been a guy that went earlier in the draft. A fourth round, I think, is an excellent spot for a guy who has a lot of college production, who played against very, very good competition. And if he can come on into LA this year and make an impact and help Jared Goff, then I think that's a good problem to have. You might not have enough ball to go around, but that's fine, because at least you have some weapons for Jared Goff to get the ball to, because coming into the draft, that was one of the biggest things we talked about. You have to get some weapons for him, and I think they did that. And, we could nitpick the draft and look at, in the fourth round, if there were some other receivers who we felt could be that bigger body matchup kind of a problem, but you're not going to find a guy with the type of college production that Farrell Cooper had, the type of toughness and physicality that he brings, the type of, he's a little bit undersized, but he makes up for that big time with the way he competes. You're not going to find those guys in the fourth round. So I think where they got him, it was a very, very nice spot. And no, he's not going to be that big body matchup guy. But he's going to be a very good player, and he's going to make an impact in 2016. And he and Jared Goff are going to grow together. And I think, more than maybe bringing in perfect pieces to fit with what they wanted to do, I think getting guys to grow as professionals with Jared Goff, to build that type of relationship, is just as important as, where you found these guys and how much of an impact they're going to make. I think you found.
And if you're going to build this, if we want to be fair too, if you're going to appropriately build some sort of system around Goff, then he worked with a lot of smaller guys that were just really quick off the line. I mean, there's a reason, you look at guys like Kenny Lawler, Bryce Treggs, et cetera. Those Sonny Dykes receivers. If Tavon Austin or Stedman Bailey were coming out of high school right now, Sonny Dykes would be recruiting the hell out of him.
Right.
He just would. He'd be like, how about you come up here to our system and play in the Bear Raid, So I do think that there is merit to it. I want to also talk about, we spent a lot of time talking about another guy that the Rams kind of drafted, at least his namesake. the Rams drafted Michael Thomas. That's not the one that we spent a lot of time talking about out of Southern Miss. Now, here's your bigger body wide receiver. He's a guy about 6'1". What are the measure? About 200 pounds is what they have him at. Maybe he could stand on and put a bit bigger frame. I just got to be honest. I haven't watched enough Southern Miss football to know how well this guy plays, but I understand that he's got exceptional hands. You know, he knows how to go up and get a ball. He doesn't drop passes, which if you've got a rookie quarterback, you've got to have guys that aren't dropping balls, man. Like, there's just, you can't have receivers dropping balls on rookie quarterbacks because depending on their mental makeup, they may start to think it's them when really it's on the receiver, and it's just categorically is bad. But what do you make of at least the pick, or if you do know anything about Michael Thomas and Warmth? I guess he goes by Mike. He's Mike Thomas. So where do you come down on him?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about him either. You know, when the Rams drafted him, I went back and kind of, you know, did some research after the fact, and I think he kind of falls in line with, a lot of the weapons that the Rams drafted in 2016. Like, he's a good body, you know, good size receiver, kind of lacks a little bit of separation. But the one thing all of these guys on the offensive side of the ball have is a high level of competitiveness. You know, players who are going to work on the field, you know, they're going to do the little things it takes to be successful. They're going to do the little dirty details that it takes to build an offense. And I think, you know, Farrell Cooper, you can look at him as a little undersized, but he more than makes up for that with his effort. Mike Thomas, same thing, not extremely quick, not extremely fast, but a good body guy. He's going to, you know, he's going to do the little things that it takes to be successful and to compete.
Blue-collar programs, you know, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be a good way to describe those guys. They brought in guys that they know are going to compete. And when you have guys that are going to compete, it's easy when you want to run the type of offense that this organization wants to run. It's easy to support a guy like Todd Gurley, and it's easy to have receivers that will get down, grind people out of the box, and have tight ends that will, you know, take on linebackers, you know, in an ISO block. You're building an offense with some toughness and some competitiveness, and anytime you do that, I think it's a positive, especially if you get a guy like Mike Thomas in the sixth round, if into the sixth round, that can come in and actually compete. It's going to be it's going to be a really, really good pickup for the Rams if that happens.
And by all accounts, none of what the Rams selected in this draft, I mean, the numbers sort of dictated that would be the case, but none of what the Rams selected in this draft seems destined to be cut. Like, when you look at the draft picks that the Rams have, you think most of these guys are going to make the 53-man roster. They need the bodies. These are the positions they need to address. And what I actually think is curious is the last guy on this list, one of the guys we haven't talked about, is actually another wide receiver. However, he decided to turn inside linebacker by the name of Josh Forrest out of Kentucky. Now, Kentucky is another one of those blue-collar programs in the SEC where it impresses me that they get some of the recruits that they do, and I wonder how much of that is because of their basketball program. But Kentucky is, man, you know, I honestly can't think of a crappy player that I've seen Kentucky put in the league. Like, they seem to put guys in there that come in and bust their ass, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's part of being a program, you know, like Kentucky and the SEC, that, you know, they have to fight just to win games, period, in the SEC. So when you come into a conference like that, you know, you're not getting five-star guys like Alabama is up and down your roster. You have guys that have a chip, and they come into the league with that chip, and they try to prove everybody wrong. And that's kind of the guy Josh Forrest is, gets recruited as a wide receiver, moves over to inside linebacker, and, you know, has a really good career at Kentucky. And, you know, is going to come in and compete in L.A. Of course, he could be a special teams guy, being the type of athlete that he is. He could be a sub guy and, you know, nickel packages, things like that. But, you know, a big athletic kid who's going to come in and compete and do what it takes to be successful. Like I said before,
I got a question for you. You're
being successful. Yeah.
I got a question for you. You look at him and you say, okay, this is a guy who's 6'3", 250 pounds. Now, depending on how athletic he is, because I can't look at his 40 time or anything right now, this guy is a former wide receiver. I mean, they do need an inside linebacker in Los Angeles, but I think they need a guy. Look, what they need is somebody who can replace what James Laurinaitis did, which is a lot of leadership, a lot of being that presence off the field, and a lot of being that guy that teammates can come to who's not afraid to go to coaches, etc. I don't think you get any of that with any rookie. So that's off the table. The only way the Rams get anything like that is if they can get this deal with Dante Whitner done. I think that's where they replace some of that with James Laurinaitis. But I'm going to ask a really stupid question here. Is there any chance that the Rams move this gentleman back? They drafted an inside linebacker, but he is a receiver, and he's a really big-bodied one.
No. Any chance to move him to wide receiver? No. There's no way. It just, you know, you go to Kentucky, you can't get on the field as a wide receiver. You go over to inside linebacker. He was a very productive inside linebacker. So, you know, it's so difficult. I know, you know, it's fun to look at guys like this, you know, that height, weight, speed combination.
I just knew somebody would ask the question somewhere.
Right. Yeah, for sure. You know, you think, oh, they can make an impact on the other side of the ball. It's so difficult for prospects to come in and make that type of transition. It takes a long time to understand the intricacies of a position when you haven't played it as long as everybody else on the field has played it. So, I think he's going to be a depth guy, a good athlete, a play special team, hopefully can develop into something more than that. But I think that's about it as far as Josh Forrest and being the prospect that they found late in the draft.
And looking at his size, you know, 6'3", 250, I think is, you know, what I said he was. Like, look, man, unless you want to add another, like, 4 or 5 inches to that and change his name to LeBron James, like, anybody who's running around at 250 is probably not going to be a receiver.
Right.
And if they are, it's LeBron James, and look out, because he's probably pretty good. You know, there aren't too many guys up there 250-plus that are flying by DBs, you know. Actually, I wonder what Mike Evans is. I do. I wonder what Mike Evans is, because he looks like a guy that, if he were muscled out, could push the boundaries of 250. But,
yeah, he probably could. I played against David Boston when he was probably 265, and, like, he couldn't move anymore. You know, David Boston at 220 was much better than the 260 David Boston. He could run by nobody. Even me as a slow safety couldn't run by me. He was big and he was physical, but yeah, it just doesn't translate. Right. It just doesn't translate.
So overall, I hate doing this because I think draft grades are stupid. So I'm going to rephrase this in a different way. There's absolutely no way to grade this draft until we see what these players become. If Carson Wentz turns out to be the one of the two that's good, then ultimately you have to go back and regrade this whole draft as an F because the Rams gave up a whole lot to get the guy that didn't work. So there's no point in grading it now when 5 years it could totally change it. What I want to look at it is based on what we know about every one of these guys, based on what we know about what the Rams needed to move forward, and based on what we know about what the Rams gave up, really leaving them with this many options, because we manipulated it a little bit after the Rams made the trade, because it left them with way fewer picks to address the holes we knew they needed to address. So given all of that, what's your executive summary on this particular draft for the Rams? For the Rams, how do you come out feeling about it?
Well, we'll start with every other prospect because I think we can kind of sum all of them up under, you know, good athletes that are going to be super competitive. They're going to come in. Jared Goff has some weapons that will help him grow in this offense, will help him grow as an NFL quarterback. And a couple of these guys, I think Tyler Higbee has to be number one on that list. Tyler Higbee could turn into a very, very good tight end, you know, a Pro Bowl caliber tight end, the skill set and size that he has. Farrell Cooper could be a very reliable guy for Jared Goff. And then, you know, I think you kind of have to move your expectations down a little bit just because, you know, the ceiling of the other guys are a little bit lower. But those first two skill guys they took off the board after Jared Goff, they could develop into some really, really good players. And this, you know, this draft, you give up so much to move up to number one. This draft comes down to how good Jared Goff develops into. I mean, if Jared Goff is a Pro Bowler, if Jared Goff starts for 10 years, nobody cares what you gave up to go get him because you went up and you got the best quarterback in the draft, and he helped bring some stability to your franchise. If Jared Goff isn't that guy, then the draft is a bust. Everybody gets fired, and, you know, they rebuild. That's just the reality of giving up that many assets to move up and pick a guy number one. If you're going to move up and pick a guy number one and give up that much, he has to be your franchise guy. And if he's not, you get fired. That's what it comes down to. And, you know, we're not, like you said, you know, it's 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we'll kind of look back and say, man, either the Rams got a steal moving up for Jared Goff, or Jeff Fisher, in his last move, Les Snead in his last move, made a huge mistake moving up to get Jared Goff. And that's how we're going to look at this draft. There's not going to be any in-between. You know, I've seen a lot of Matt Ryan comparisons to Jared Goff. If Jared Goff turns into Matt Ryan, I think this draft is a success. You moved up and got a guy that can at least give you a chance, because with the quarterbacks they had on this roster, you didn't have a chance.
I don't know why everyone's so high on Matty Ice. I've yet to see it. Like, I outside of that 14-2 season for the Falcons, where Matt Ryan basically did nothing in the playoffs, I've not seen it. I mean, somebody's going to have to sell me on Matt Ryan one day. Like, what is it about him that the X's and O's guys love based on the guys who watch him play? Can you explain briefly to me what it is? Is it what am I missing that I should that your experience allows you to see?
Well, I'm not extremely high on Matt Ryan, but Matt Ryan, the conversations I have before the season starts. Do you have a guy at quarterback or not? If you don't, then you don't have a chance to win the Super Bowl. The Falcons have a chance to win the Super Bowl because Matt Ryan is at least good enough to be that guy. Now, he hasn't won big games in his career, but Matt Ryan is a guy with the appropriate supporting cast. I think he can lead a team to a Super Bowl. He does things well enough that he allows his weapons to make plays. He doesn't make big mistakes that cost the Falcons games on a regular basis. He's a good enough athlete to get himself out of trouble, and if you have, you know, Julio and you have another guy and you have a run game, Matt Ryan can lead you to a Super Bowl. And if you have that type of a quarterback, like, he's not a top five guy at all, you know, he's not in that equation, but you have a guy that gives you a chance to make it to a Super Bowl. And when you have that, you're, you know, a cut above 20 teams in the league. And if Jared Goff turns into that, I think you would have to say that this is a success.
All right. Well, let's get some listener questions in here before we wrap things up and go on our ways. So Corey McCarthy is going to make you do what I see. I'm going to direct a question to you so I don't have to do it. What grade would you give the Rams draft?
I give an incomplete. How about that? Give an incomplete that. Because it all comes down to Jared Goff. And I think I know it's fun to talk about and get some conversation going, but it's impossible to grade a draft without really understanding all the value. Like, I think teams can grade drafts because you put a certain value on each slot and you match that up with.
I'm sure if you went back and regraded whatever it was that the New England Patriots had the year they drafted Tom Brady, I am 1,000,000,000% certain that you would rate that draft so much differently. That sixth-round quarterback is probably quite literally the steal of the draft.
Yeah, right, and you didn't know that for a while. But I think if you look at the prospects you get versus where you drafted them, then I think you can get a kind of an idea. And this, you know, the Rams comes down to Jared Goff and that's it. But I think they did find some talented guys, you know, in good value spots. Tyler Higbee in the fourth, I think, is great. Farrell Cooper in the fourth, I think, was great. Hemingway in the sixth, I think, was also great. And then you get Michael Thomas, who, you know, could develop into a good wide receiver late in the sixth. So if you look at just value, where they got these prospects, I think that the Rams did a good job. So just based on that, I would say this is a B draft, and it all comes down to, you know, how Jared Goff performs, and that's ultimately 3 years down the road where we will come and rank this draft.
I'm going to actually start borrowing that phrase because incomplete is actually a grade for those of you who went to college.
So did I.
I will direct this next one to you, and then the last one we can kind of answer together simultaneously because I've seen some, well, not simultaneously answer it, but we'll take turns answering it. How about that? This one is just for you. Do you see Goff as a starter come week one, or will the Rams go with Keenum or Mannion?
Yeah, I think he's a starter week one. I think the Rams, like, this isn't about 2016, not at all, but I think Jared Goff is experienced enough, and with the type of offense that they want to put him in, with Todd Gurley running the football, I think he can step in and be a week one starter. Like, he'll make mistakes, he'll, you know, turn the ball over, he'll do things like that, but he has enough right now to be a week one starter. He's better than anybody else on their roster, unless he completely botches, you know, dropping back from under quarter or from under center, I think he's the week one starter.
And more importantly, I can't think of a quarterback drafted number one, number two overall in that range who hasn't been a starter in like the last 5 years. Like, that, maybe there was a time in the NFL when being drafted this high meant you sat behind somebody, but that time is long since passed, and I can't recall what it is. If somebody gave up that much to get you, you better get your ass ready because you're starting week one. Like, that's the plan. That's at least the plan would be how I would see that. You just don't give up that much and draft a guy who you think is that talented to say, you know what, we're going to have him sit and learn behind guys who are worse than him. Because what's he going to learn? And the stuff he is going to learn, you probably don't want him learning. Now, the last question we have comes from Matt, and he wants to know, with the Rams making a decision on a local radio home, are there any guesses to which station will be selected? You're in the radio business, Rand. Cam, have you heard anything?
No, I haven't. I've heard nothing. I don't know AM, FM, what it's going to be. I don't know any, you know, insider information. There was a station that's no longer a sports talk station that I thought was going to be the home, but they've since moved on from that. So outside of that, I have just no at all information that would help me understand who that may be.
Now here's where I can chip in. Vinny Bonsignor has been tweeting about this for some time, and it looks like ESPN 710 LA is the most notable frontrunner, the names that fans would recognize. However, and Vinny's not released the name, he said that there is a bidding war going on and that some of the people or some of the parties involved would actually surprise fans. So I guess it'll be a wait-and-see situation, but it does look like ESPN 710 LA would be, if you were to throw a dart at the likeliest destination, that seems like what it would be, which would make total sense. because ESPN affiliates tend to work hard to get those contracts for all the obvious reasons, and the money that comes with them and the listenership. So it looks like that may be the reason, but don't discount some of these other unnamed parties. Now, Vinny may have tweeted a bit more on this since we've been on air. I don't know. But if you go and check Vinny Bonsignor's timeline from today, what is today, the 2nd, Monday, April 2nd, I think, go and check Vinny Bonsignor's timeline from today, Monday, April 2nd, and you'll see at least some information about the radio bidding war. So that's why I said we could both chip in on that one. Is right before we got on air, Vinny was tweeting about that, and I thought that was interesting. So my guess, though, is it's going to end up on ESPN 710 LA, which is also the home of the Trojans. Like, if they're playing at the Coliseum, I'm sure USC would throw their weight behind the deal or something. Like, it's just, you're going to want all of that in one place, but that may be why it doesn't end up happening. So I don't have the insider scoop for you guys on that one. Radio contracts are serious business, and they don't get leaked to lowly people like me. But Vinny knows, so go and check out with him. Other than that, Cam, any last draft day surprises, draft day thoughts, some guys that you fit went to some clubs that maybe you were a bit surprised by some dumb picks, some great picks?
I really like the Jags getting Miles Jack in the 2nd round. He was a guy who I thought...
Along with Jalen Ramsey? Oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, the guy who I thought would be the Jags pick at number 5 in the 1st round, they get him at 35 in the 2nd round. So for me, that's just... I love Miles Jack. I know there's some issues around his knee and things like that, but I love him. I think he is a tremendous, tremendous player, and he's going to be a star as long as he's healthy. And hopefully that's for, you know, 15 years. Hopefully he continues to be productive and, you know, is just a stalwart linebacker, because I love to watch him play. He's a unique talent and you know, could be transcendent.
And imagine him playing alongside Dante Fowler Jr. too. Because remember, Dante Fowler hasn't played a snap. And if he and Miles Jack and Jalen Ramsey all enter this team at the same time, and holy crap, dude.
Yeah, that's
like,
that's
we could be looking
good
at like a Jaguars dynasty, weird as that sounds to say.
The Jags, they have weapons. Blake Bortles is continuing to get better. I think he has a higher ceiling than any quarterback that came out in that draft class a couple years ago. And now they're starting to build that defense. Robert Kendiche to the Cardinals, we mentioned a little bit earlier. Late in the 1st round to get him, I think, was just a steal by the Cardinals. They're, you know, if you can't go and play football for Bruce Arians, you can't play football for anybody. And that is the ideal spot for Kendiche to be. I think
there would have been a bad pick for anybody else in the 1st round. You think, though? Like, I think that going to Bruce Arians and the Cardinals, who have a proven track record of dealing with athletes like this, I think that's a component, at least for me, of what makes this pick a steal. Like, if he'd have ended up with Jackson in Cleveland, I'd have been like, that's a dumbass pick.
Right.
You know, like, but because of the fact of what they were able to do with Tyrann Mathieu, it's an outstanding pick for me.
Yeah, and he could have gone to the Patriots. I think he would have been fine. I think if he would have gone to Cincinnati and played for Marvin Lewis, I think he would have been fine. But, you know, no situation is better for him, especially because Tyrann Mathieu, you know, came out of college with a lot of the same question marks. Now, Kendiche didn't get into trouble like Tyrann Mathieu did, but some of the same question marks around him, and Bruce Arians and that staff have done an excellent job turning Tyrann Mathieu around. I think they're going to do the same thing with Robert Kendiche. He's a top 10 talent, and he made the Cardinals a lot better. I think the Cardinals did an excellent job grabbing him and getting him where they did right towards the end of the 1st round.
So what do you think about reaches in the draft? Because I'm going to start with my reach, and I'm going to stay with the Browns. Cody Kessler in the third round I thought was a tremendous reach. I think Cody Kessler is a fourth or fifth round talent. But with that said, if you're the Browns and you have more picks than anybody else in the draft, like, you can burn up one of those picks on a reach, right?
Yeah, look, I'm biased because, you know, Cody Kessler was kind of our first star at passing down back in 2009, and I've loved watching him play. I know he's limited as far as, you know, the arm that he brings to the NFL. He's a little bit undersized, but I'm going to defer to Hugh Jackson on this one. Maybe this is a cop-out because, like I said, I am biased. But Hugh said, you got to trust me. I look at Cody Kessler, and who do I see? I see Andy Dalton. Hugh Jackson turned Andy Dalton into a Pro Bowler who just got paid. So I know Cody Kessler is a much, he's a much, you know, better competitor than Andy Dalton is. When the spotlight is on him, he's going to show up. So, you know, I think Hugh Jackson turned Andy Dalton into what he did. I think he turned Cody Kessler into that and even more because Cody Kessler is going to, he's going to come to work every day. He's going to try to prove everybody wrong. To me, the biggest reach, and I don't think it's a reach, but the Titans traded up to pick an offensive lineman, and they picked Jack Conklin from Michigan State when Laremy Tunsil was on the board. That just, I'm sorry, I can't, you know, I cannot excuse that one when you have the premier left tackle on the board and you don't draft him and you pick a guy, and Jack Conklin is going to be a fine NFL offensive lineman, but he is nowhere close to the same level of prospect as Laremy Tunsil is. Nowhere close. So to trade up and make that pick when you could have had Laremy Tunsil, I think was a tremendous reach. And I think they're going to, you know, they might not regret it because Jack Conklin is going to be just fine. But when you look down at South Beach and see Laremy Tunsil going to Pro Bowl after Pro Bowl after Pro Bowl, you're going to look back and think you made a tremendous mistake not picking him when you had the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you on every count of Tunsil. I look at Cody Kessler, though, and I think there are a lot of USC fans gritting their teeth about when the lights show up, Cody Kessler shows up, when the lights are on, Cody Kessler shows up, because he really didn't. He was 0 for the millennium against Notre Dame in his USC career. He only barely got the only win he ever had over UCLA is when they started a true freshman in Josh Rosen. And he didn't do well against Arizona or Arizona State. There were just a lot of things in Cody Kessler's career that went against Stanford. He was the killer, and then Stanford got their, you know, their mojo back. My problem with Kessler was this. This was always my biggest problem with Kessler. It wasn't so much who he was. It wasn't even the limited arm strength. It's that whenever I saw Cody Kessler go through the progressions, he never went through them. He looked for Juju Smith in time and time and time again with bypass open options to throw to a double or triple covered Smith-Schuster. And there was a staggering stat out there, like two staggering stats. The leading receiver on USC was Juju Smith-Schuster. The team's second leading receiver, do you know who it was, and do you know how many yards he had?
No.
Okay, the team's second leading receiver was cornerback Adoree Jackson with 474 yards. That was the second leading receiver on a team like USC that threw the ball as much as they did. Juju Smith, Adoree Jackson had 1,000 less yards, actually more than 1,000 fewer yards receiving than did Juju Smith-Schuster, and he was a cornerback as the team's second-leading receiver. That's a problem. 46% of USC's offense funneled from Kessler to Juju Smith-Schuster, and he never, ever, ever showed an ability to move past his ability, or excuse me, he never ever showed an ability to move past that sort of block in his progression reads that would allow him to see these other open targets. And I think that even after when Cody Kessler left, you saw USC players throwing shade at him. Like, Daquan Hampton was speaking very publicly and was like, yeah, man, so the very first thing we've noticed this year in practice is that that everybody else besides Juju Smith-Schuster catches the ball. And it was very pointed at Cody Kessler. He was asked to elaborate, and he happily did. And that sentiment was echoed by other receivers on the team who felt like Kessler really wasn't that good. And if your own teammates are kind of calling you out publicly and saying you're not that good at your job, that's not a very good sign moving forward toward the future. There's a reason that Cody Kessler never won anything of importance at USC. And if that reason is because he doesn't have it in him. And I know that you have a bias. I totally understand that. That's fair. I just think that Cody Kessler does not have it in him. He's a medium-time quarterback. I'm not going to say a small time. I'm not going to say a big time. I do think he's a medium-time quarterback. I hate the phrase game manager, and it almost applies to Cody, but it doesn't quite because Cody will actually go through stuff and still decide to make bad decisions even when he shouldn't. And so in that sense, he's not a game manager because a game manager would have made a different decision than he did in that moment because their job is to manage the game. Most game managers don't throw into triple coverage. They'll take too many sacks, but they don't throw into triple coverage on a repeated basis. That's what Cody Kessler did. He always did it. And I just never saw anything out of him in big moments that led me to believe that he would ever be anything more than a backup in the NFL. So to spend a third-round pick on him, I thought for Cleveland, would have been a bit of a stretch. But I backed that up by saying Cleveland stockpiled all of those picks for a reason. They knew that roster needed a massive overhaul and a culture change. And what better way to do that than by bringing in a bunch of guys with a winning attitude? And Cody Kessler always has a winning mentality. He has that mind right. He has that mindset. He will go out there, and he is a blue-collar guy, man. He's from the Central Valley. He's going to go in there. He's going to bust his hump every single day, and he's going to give you what he has. And he's going to push the other guys around him. And if he does that for the Cleveland Browns, then he would have easily been worth a third-round pick. If he can drive, whomever is going to be their franchise quarterback, because they didn't take him this year, but whoever is going to be their franchise quarterback, Cody Kessler is the type of guy that's going to push him to become the next best version of himself. And I think that when you have that guy as a backup, and you enter into a situation almost where it's like it's Tom Brady and Drew Bledsoe, that's fine. You want that, man. You want a backup who's capable of going in there and not just, you know, managing the situation, but also producing you a couple of wins. Because there are no guarantees in the NFL, and the schedule is hectic. And if you've got a guy who can go in there when your quarterback, you know, is out for four games for whatever reason, and he can go 3-1 or 2-2 during that stretch, that's invaluable in this league. And I think Cody Kessler can be that. But I didn't like that he went in the third round just because I don't think he was a third-round quarterback. But I think that's all offset by Cleveland having the picks to burn such that they can take him in the third round. Is that at least fair? Am I staying in bounds there with him?
Yeah, I think that's all very fair. And you watched more of him at USC than I did. And I guess you do bring up a good point that he did not always excel in the big games at USC. But I think when I say a guy that will show up when the lights come on, you know, he's a guy that will always compete. He will always lead. But his production, you're right, didn't always match his competitiveness. It didn't always match, you know, his will to try to win. And I think that's something that, you know, with Hugh Jackson will be improved. And he's a guy that, you know, probably doesn't have as high of a ceiling as some third-round quarterbacks that we see go, but, you know, I would trust Cody Kessler to run my offense, and I would feel good with him working under Hugh Jackson. maybe I'm wrong. We'll revisit this in a couple of years and see if Cody Kessler has made that transition. But I know a lot of Browns fans, a lot of USC fans were shocked that he went as high as he did. And, you know, all I can do is defer to Hugh Jackson when he said, you just got to trust me with this pick. And we'll see what he does with this. The first quarterback Hugh Jackson has drafted as a head coach, and he's a guy who's extremely good at developing those guys. So, you know, we'll see what he can do with a guy like Cody Kessler.
I just see Cody Kessler as almost exactly like Matt Barkley. And I thought that Matt Barkley's stats and Cody Kessler's stats from his junior year, they're aberrations. You know, 39 touchdowns and 7 interceptions is not who Cody Kessler is by any stretch of the imagination. Like, even going back to when Cody Kessler was competing for the job against Max Whittick, I remember seeing, and this was against Hawaii, and it wasn't against a very good Hawaii team at all, which was the crazy part, but Hawaii, obviously, they knew they were up against it, so they basically sent pressure the whole game. I mean, what other option do they have? You know, like, maybe we can force some turnovers, maybe we can contain these guys, but to a man, our corners are not going to be able to run with their receivers, so we've got to force Cody Kessler into making mistakes. And they were aided by the fact at the time that Lane Kiffin was pushing for Max Whittick to get the job, so that's why he was literally giving him every opportunity he could instead of doing right. What he should have done all along and just announced Cody Kessler as the starter. But in that game, Hawaii was sending pressure, and I remember as the pocket was collapsing around Kessler, he just started, like, dancing. He was literally dancing, jumping up with both feet, and, like, looking, and then he threw this panicked football that landed right in the arms of a Rainbow Warrior middle linebacker, and I'm thinking, what was that? Like, what was that? Like, I don't mind the interception, but what the hell was that little ditty before you threw the interception? What are you doing? Like, you look like a guy who's playing Madden for the first time against somebody who's really good. Like, you just almost look like you did not know what you were doing. And those same sort of mistakes just kept happening. And so I think if Hugh Jackson can work with him on those progressions and staying a bit more comfortable in the pocket, you're right. If Hugh Jackson thinks he can work with him, I've got no reason to think that he can't. But then again, Raiders fans would argue otherwise. So, I mean, it's a funny game, this NFL. But I don't know, man. I think it's been one hell of a podcast, one hell of a draft, one hell of a long draft.
Yeah.
It seemed like it took forever. What do you got coming up in your downtime, man, before we get out of here?
Oh, just the regular show, you know, on 940 ESPN here in Fresno. You know, fans can listen to it. They can find it on my Twitter, you know, bio, 940ESPNFresno.com. Other than that, man, just a little bit of chilling, kind of slowing down a little bit after passing down spring, the draft, and getting this wedding out of the way. So I'm excited to have some downtime. My girls play soccer, so it'll be a little traveling for soccer, but excited just to kind of take some downtime. And then jump into the passing down junior high in June and get it going again.
And certainly we will be taking a very close look at all things Rams. We'll figure out where some of these guys are going to slot in once they join team activities and get their contracts signed. But, man, I'll tell you what, man, that Best of the West was an enormous amount of fun. I had a blast being down there. I can't wait to do it again the next time. And if you don't already follow us on Twitter, he is at Cam Laurel. I am at Fight On Twist. And you can follow the site at LA_Rams Report. Still not gotten rid of it. Don't forget to follow our publisher, Ryan Abraham. Who decided to spend yesterday with Dan Wojcicki and Colin Cowherd at a Dodger baseball game. So, you know, while we're over here plugging away on Rams crap, Ryan's going big time and it with some celebrities at Dodger Stadium. So, way to go, Ryan.
Yeah, it sounds like a good time.
I know. We should do that with the Giants game and then send him a picture posted on Twitter. Like,
I like
maybe we'll get Derek or something to go and be like, suck it.
I like it.
And other than that, I think that about does it for this episode of Flipping Tables. We'll be back next week. We're going to try and land another guest. This week was obviously short notice. And really, anybody who was worth anything was already tied up with pre-arranged agreements with other organizations because the draft is that dang important. So hopefully now, as those guys start to come free of their responsibilities with some of the larger publications, we can snag a couple of them, get them on here on the Flipping Tables podcast, and get their analysis on the Rams trade. So get those questions sent in, send them to myself, send them to Cam Worrell, and other than that, man, we will catch you next time here on Flipping Tables Podcast, the Rock LA Rams Report.